Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight.
It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie.
A key witness, a top aide to former President Trump's chief of staff, testifies that the former president encouraged January 6th protesters to march to the Capitol, knowing they had weapons, and he tried to join them. Then, tragedy in Texas. Dozens of migrants perished after being locked in a tractor trailer in scorching heat, the deadliest human smuggling accident in the U.S. in modern memory. And the end of Roe, the Supreme Court's decision to restrict reproductive rights, forces women to seek abortions across state lines and leaves clinics scrambling to keep up with demand.
It's difficult to imagine how this ramp up will occur to be able to take care of all these extra patients. One day we're seeing our usual number of patients, and the next day 20,000 more people who are calling.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol today held a quickly scheduled hearing, its sixth this month, to present what it called new and urgent evidence about what former President Donald Trump knew and said before, during, and after the insurrection. Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, presented the most compelling and detailed account yet of the actions of the former president's inner circle. And she shared her own reaction as she watched the events of January 6th.
I remember feeling frustrated, disappointed, and really, it felt personal. I was really sad. As an American, I was disgusted. It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie.
Today was the first time Hutchinson publicly appeared before the committee, but she has spoken several other times behind closed doors. And in video from those depositions, Hutchinson explained that Trump knew some of the members of the crowd were armed with weapons because he grew frustrated about the Secret Service security procedures, specifically the metal detectors, making the crowd at his January 6th speech smaller than he wanted.
He wanted it full, and he was angry that we weren't letting people through the mags with weapons. I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
Our congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins and White House correspondent Laura Barone Lopez have been following the hearings today. They both join me now. Laura, let me begin with you. Cassidy Hutchinson, not a name we were familiar with, but she was at the center of so much what was going on in the White House, certainly had a lot of access. How did she fill in the timeline of what took place?
That's right, Judy. So Cassidy Hutchinson has worked for Republicans for a very long time, and she was in daily contact with her boss, Mark Meadows, as well as a lot of other senior White House officials throughout her time in the White House and leading up to January 6th. She testified that on multiple occasions there were warnings and raised concerns about threats of violence on that day. She said that she overheard Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's lawyer, talking about Proud Boys and Oath Keepers being present at the events that day. And then she also gave very important testimony about an exchange that she had with Pat Cipollone, White House counsel to President Trump. And in that exchange, Cipollone told Hutchinson on January 3rd that he was really worried about legal concerns that the White House could face if President Trump decided to go to the Capitol on January 6th, making a movement that would be very logistically difficult. And he also warned her again on the morning of January 6th. Here's what Cipollone said to Hutchinson.
And we understand, Ms. Hutchinson, that you also spoke to Mr. Cipollone on the morning of the 6th as you were about to go to the rally on the Ellipse. And Mr. Cipollone said something to you like, make sure the movement to the Capitol does not happen. Is that correct?
That's correct. I saw Mr. Cipollone right before I walked out onto West Exec that morning, and Mr. Cipollone said something to the effect of, please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. Keep in touch with me. We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen.
Now, that exchange that Hutchinson recalled was new. We had never heard that before. And also the specific crimes that Cipollone was talking about, he told Hutchinson that he thought that they could face obstruction of proceeding charges, as well as defrauding of electors charges. And still, despite all of those warnings, the president wanted to go to the Capitol and urged his staff to make it possible for him.
And Laura, Cassidy Hutchinson testified about how she traveled in the president's motorcade to the rally that was taking place on the morning of January 6th. And she also testified about the president's reaction when he learned that a number of the people at that rally or in that area were carrying weapons.
That's right. As you mentioned earlier, Judy, the president was really upset that his supporters were not being allowed into where his speech was at, which is the Ellipse, which is right outside of the White House. And it was because that they had weapons, they had knives, they had other, very dangerous paraphernalia on them. And the president said, let them through. They aren't going to hurt me. And that that he was pretty much dismissing threats of a violence. Now, after his speech at that Stop the Steal rally with his supporters, the president then went to go get into his motorcade, into the vehicle that we call the Beast. And when he got in with Robert Engel, who was his top Secret Service agent that day. And he was under the impression that he was going to be able to go from that speech to the Capitol along with his supporters. And when he was told by Robert Engel that he was not going to be able to do that due to resources, here's how the president reacted.
The president had very strong, very angry response to that. Tony described him as being irate. The president said something to the effect of, I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now. To which Bobby responded, sir, we have to go back to the West Wing. The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol. Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motion towards his clavicles.
Hutchinson was told that exchange about that episode in The Beast by Anthony Ornato, who was then deputy chief of staff to the president. And she said that when she was told that when they returned to the White House, because again, she was in the motorcade with the president throughout the day when he went to the speech, when he came back to the White House from the speech. And she said that when she was told that Robert Engel was standing there in the room, again, that Secret Service agent with the president, and he did not refute anything that was said in that episode. And as the day went on, then rioters broke into the Capitol, which we all watched as they started to descend into the Senate. And Hutchinson said that at that point, she witnessed Pat Cipollone, White House counsel to the president, confront Mark Meadows, chief of staff, and that Cipollone was very concerned because we were starting to hear chants about hanging Vice President Mike Pence from the rioters that had descended on the Capitol. And here is what Cipollone said to Meadows.
I remember Pat saying something to the effect of, Mark, we need to do something more. They're literally calling for the vice president to be effing hung. And Mark had responded something to the effect of, you heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it. He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong.
The big picture here, Judy, is that we've heard from Hutchinson's testimony time and again, all of the warning signs and all of the concerns about what would happen on January 6th, and that the president appeared to be dismissing the threats of violence, not just to members of Congress, but also to his vice president.
And I'm going to have Lisa pick it up from here. Lisa, when it comes to the president's then chief of staff, Mark Meadows. We did learn more today about his role in all this.
That's right. A lot of names here, but central is Mark Meadows. And let's remind our viewers who we're talking about in his own history. Mark Meadows came to Congress as a member from North Carolina. And we can look at some of the associations in a graphic that we have here. There you go. Mark Meadows, he, in 2015, formed the Freedom Caucus with Congressman Jim Jordan. And then in 2020, he became the chief of staff to President Trump. Central figure, and what we heard described today in testimony, Judy, was a picture of a chief of staff who was not acting to the degree to which it almost seemed it was a passiveness that may have bordered on permissiveness of what was going on in the White House's Oval Office. On January 2nd in particular, Cassidy Hutchinson described a conversation with Rudy Giuliani. She was walking him out of the White House. He brought up plans for January 6th in a way that really got on her radar like never before. She walked back into the White House, and she was asked today, did she then talk to Mark Meadows, her boss, about what she heard from Giuliani? Here's her response.
I went back up to our office, and I found Mr. Meadows in his office on the couch. He was scrolling through his phone. I remember leaning against the doorway and saying, I had an interesting conversation with Rudy. Mark, sounds like we're going to go to the Capitol. He didn't look up from his phone and said something to the effect of, there's a lot going on, Cass, but I don't know. Things might get real, real bad on January 6th. That evening was the first moment that I remember feeling scared and nervous for what could happen on January 6th.
Fast forward to January 6th, and Hutchinson says her boss, Mark Meadows, was unresponsive to her pleas to pay attention to what was going on at the Capitol. He wasn't even really concerned about Jim Jordan when she first brought that issue up. And then she recounted this moment when White House counsel Pat Cipollone reached out to Meadows to try and get him to get the president more involved. Here's that conversation.
The rioters have gotten to the Capitol, Mark. We need to go down and see the president now. And Mark looked up at him and said, he doesn't want to do anything, Pat. And Pat said something to the effect of, and very clearly had said this to Mark, something to the effect of, Mark, something needs to be done or people are going to die and the blood's going to be on your effing hands. This is getting out of control. I'm going down there.
Just extraordinary testimony. We also heard today that from Hutchinson that Meadows himself asked for a pardon. We, of course, reached out to Mr. Meadows' attorneys for a response to all of this. We have not heard back yet.
Lisa, there was literally one explosive disclosure after another. Anything else you would add that was noteworthy in the way of accusations? And how are the former president and the others around him responding to all this?
I will say some Republicans have reacted in texts with me, direct messages, with just a simple exclamation point. But it's important to point out that the president has, in fact, been responding today. Here are some of the quotes that he's put out on social media today. First, he said of Hutchinson, I hardly know who this person is. Of that limo anecdote, the idea that he reached out and assaulted a security aide, he said that's a fake story. And he also said there's no cross-examination for this so-called witnesses. This is a kangaroo court. And I should remind viewers, of course, that former President Trump in the past has disassociated himself, said he doesn't know people that we know he has been associated with in the past. So I want to add that piece of context. Now, overall, let's talk about all these accusations. Laura and I presented a lot of reporting. It's easy to get lost in, but we wanted to summarize what we learned today overall. First, that President Trump knew about weapons here in Washington, D.C., and a chance for violence from the crowd as it was getting ready to go to the Capitol, and that he himself wanted to march into the Capitol with the crowd. The other accusation is that he assaulted the security chief sworn to protect him because he wanted to take over and get himself to the Capitol. And then another accusation, Judy, that's important, witness tampering. The committee said that they now have messages from Trump allies to witnesses saying that they are sure they will be loyal. That, of course, is also a potential federal crime. And I think with all of this, what we're seeing now is the committee kind of honing more and more evidence for criminal cases that still remains in the hands of the Department of Justice, of course. And we also know more hearings are ahead. We don't know when.
That's right. They pointed to hearings upcoming, more information to be disclosed. Lisa Desjardins, Laura Barone-Lopez, we thank you both. And joining me now to further unpack what we learned today are Andrea Bernstein. She is co-host of the Will Be Wild podcast, examining the events leading up to and through January 6th. She's also a regular NPR contributor. And Jamil Jaffer, he is a law professor at George Mason University and a former associate counsel to President George W. Bush. Welcome to both of you. There were so many disclosures and bits of new information today, it's hard to know even where to begin. But as you look at it all, Andrea Bernstein, what is standing out the most to you?
Well, I think what we began to see today was a connection between Trump and the violent activity that happened on January 6th. So what we've known so far is that he pressured his Justice Department to try to overturn state electors, that he pressured Mike Pence, that he pressured state legislators and state local officials. But what we heard today was a knowledge of President Trump that people in the crowd before him had weapons, flagpoles tipped with spear, body armor, pepper spray, bear spray, that they couldn't get in to see him because they didn't want to lay down their weapons. And that even with that, he went up in front of them and said, fight like hell, we're going to go to the Capitol, I'll be there with you. Now, one of the things we learned today is at that time he really did believe he was going to the Capitol until his Secret Service team didn't let him go. But I think what's emerging is a sense that this violence was understood by the president. The White House had warnings of violence. Rudy Giuliani was saying as early as January 2nd that something was going to happen on January 6th. So what this does is it moves us closer to the question of, was President Trump, what did he know about the planned violence? We don't know all of it, but we know that he knew that there was a weaponized, riled up crowd and that he himself was extremely riled up when he made that speech on the Ellipse on January 6th.
And Jamil Jaffer, what about for you? What is standing out the most for you?
Yeah, you know, I think, Judy, Andrew is exactly right. The idea that the president knew the crowd was armed, was not worried that they were going to target him, that they were going to threaten him, but that instead we're actually going to threaten the Capitol and we're going to planning on marching the Capitol, and that he was supportive of that and called upon them to do that, I think is pretty shocking direct evidence. And then on top of that, you add the fact that after the fact, when Pat Cipollone comes into the Oval Office with Mark Meadows and they leave and they're discussing what happened in the Oval, and Mark Meadows is saying to Cipollone, look, the president thinks Mike Pence deserves this, with the chance of saying, hang Mike Pence, he thinks he deserves it. And that that these people, these who have stormed the Capitol, are doing nothing wrong. I mean, that is not the kind of behavior you expect from any president at all. And it's just shocking to me that you don't see more congressional Republicans today running fast away from Donald Trump, because it is just shocking and astounding what we heard today.
Well, speaking of that, Andrea Bernstein, how surprising is it that a number of White House key people, including Pat Cipollone, were concerned in the hours and the days leading up to January 6th about what happened?
Well, I think we've had some inkling of this. We know, for example, that Pat Cipollone was one of the people who didn't want Trump to replace his acting attorney general with another acting attorney general. So there's been an indication that there was concern around the White House. I think what was different today is we had this direct testimony from a White House aide, a young woman coming before this committee. I mean, most of the witnesses have been older men. And there she is, and she is saying, under oath, and obviously lying to Congress is a felony. And she went up there and she spoke the truth. And we saw people like former General Mike Flynn, who had been convicted of lying to the FBI previously before Trump pardoned him, taking the Fifth Amendment and not even answering the question about whether he thought blocking the peaceful transfer of power was a crime. So that contrast was stark today. And I think having that eyewitness testimony really took us further into understanding what was going on in the White House up to and on January 6th.
It was such a sharp contrast. You're absolutely right. Jamil Jaffer, what about in terms of evidence or information we heard today that is legally incriminating for the president, former president?
Well, look, I think that we've always long known that as a legal matter, there are some real challenges bringing a case against a former president, particularly about issues relating to politics and elections and the like. This would be a difficult case to make. It would run the Justice Department into the problems of being accused of being political. So I think it's hard to do. I do think what's interesting is what happened right at the end of the hearing, where you had Trump world people calling potential witnesses before Congress and saying, hey, look, the president knows you're loyal. He's thinking of you today. I mean, this is something you'd see literally in, you know, Goodfellas or Casino. It's straight out of a Mafia Don movie. And that actually may be actionable, right? Maybe not the actions of the president, but potentially the actions of his aides who said these things, and maybe all the way up to the president, just like you'd work up to a mafia boss threatening witnesses before Congress. That is a crime, and that is something a referral could be made on, and that may be the place that Congress goes. I think it's going to be a lot harder for them to get some of these other charges they've been talking about against the president, these obstruction, these conspiracy charges, much more difficult to prove, particularly in the context of an ongoing election and a sitting president at the time.
What about that, Andrea Bernstein? I know you talked to a number of people around this. What are you hearing in terms of whether the president could now be in serious legal jeopardy, the former president could be in serious legal jeopardy?
His own White House counsel thought he was going to be in serious legal jeopardy if he went to the Capitol. And he warned specifically, according to Cassidy Hutchinson, that the president could be charged with obstruction of a obstruction of an official proceeding, fraud, or inciting a riot. Now, that is if the president went to the Capitol. But it is quite stark that the White House lawyer told the president that the White House lawyer warned the chief of staff the president could have blood on his hands. So that isn't me speaking. That is the man who, in the president's first impeachment, essentially blocked all witness participation coming from the White House. So this is somebody who was very loyal to Trump, who was saying these things at the end of the day. So I think that there is concern there. And then I think at the very end of the hearing, the sort of dramatic finale was when Representative Cheney asked Cassidy Hutchinson whether Meadows asked for a pardon. And she said, yes, he did. Mm-hmm. And that was the sort of then the curtain dropped on her testimony, and that leaves a very strong sense that he thought he'd done something wrong. And I think, you know, now we have this break in the hearings, presumably, unless they call us back, and that is left ringing in the air for, you know, all of us to hear, but the Justice Department to think about as well, as I think whether to bring charges against the president and or people around him.
And just a very quick answer from you, Jamil Jaffer, on the fact that some of what Cassidy Hutchinson testified today was hearsay. It was what she heard other people describing. How does that hold up compared to what she personally witnessed?
I mean, look, certainly it was hearsay. She was describing what other people said. But at the end of the day, she was a fact witness to a lot of what happened. She saw a lot of what happened. She heard the president speak. At the end of the day, there are going to be other witnesses called. Unless they refute what Cassidy Hutchinson has said, I think the story sticks, and it's a real, real problem for the president and for any Republicans that seek to back the president in a further election or the like.
Jamil Jaffer, Andrea Bernstein, we thank you both.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, the death toll rose to 51 in a migrant smuggling horror story in Texas. They were found Monday evening, packed into a tractor trailer rig parked in San Antonio. Temperatures were near 100 degrees. President Biden called it horrifying and heartbreaking. We'll get details after the news summary. There is more fallout from the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe versus Wade. A Texas judge today blocked a 1925 law that banned nearly all abortions. A federal appeals court allowed a Tennessee ban after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services said that he will consider all options for abortion access if they pass legal muster.
We're not interested in going rogue and doing things just because. And so to every American who's impacted, my apologies that we can't tell you there's a silver bullet.
One option could be setting up abortion clinics on federal land, but the White House warned patients and providers could still be prosecuted under state laws. It is primary night again, with elections in six states and several marquee races. Republican Tina Peters is running to be Colorado's top elections official. She has been indicted for election fraud, and she rejects the 2020 election results. And New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul faces primary challenges after stepping in when Andrew Cuomo resigned. Advisors to the FDA are recommending that COVID vaccines be tweaked to match the highly contagious offshoots of the Omicron variant. The panel voted today for adding new protections to updated boosters this fall. The recommendation now goes to the full FDA. In central Ukraine, rescuers kept digging today in the ruins of a burned-out shopping mall hit by Russian missiles. Firefighters cleared rubble from Monday's attack in Kremenchuk. It killed at least 18 people, with 21 still missing. But Ukraine's interior minister said no one could have survived the intense heat.
We can now say for sure there are no living people remaining. At such temperatures, bodies can burn out completely. So we can't rule out that a certain amount of people, remains, will be recovered only after the site is completely cleared.
Meanwhile, the Group of Seven democracies pledged to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. And significantly, Turkey dropped its opposition to letting Sweden and Finland join the NATO alliance as alliance leaders convened in Spain. We'll return to all of this later in the program. The United Nations now says that the first decade of Syria's civil war killed more than 300,000 civilians. It is the highest official estimate yet, but it does not include thousands who died from lack of health care or food. Syria's war began in 2011. A court in Germany has convicted a former Nazi concentration camp guard of more than 3,500 counts of accessory to murder. The defendant, identified only as Joseph S., is 101 years old. He entered a courtroom today in a wheelchair, hiding his face with a blue folder. The granddaughter of a prisoner at the Sachsenhausen camp welcomed the outcome.
But I think it's really important that my generation and the future generation, as there will no longer be direct witnesses of this history, that we keep on this memory.
The suspect was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Back in this country, a federal court in New York sentenced Ghislaine Maxwell to 20 years in prison for steering young girls to Jeffrey Epstein for sexual abuse. The British socialite told the court that meeting the financier was the greatest regret of her life. Epstein died of suicide in 2019. Suspected hate crimes in California have hit their highest level since after 9/11. The state says there were nearly 1,800 reported incidents last year, up 33% from a year earlier. Reports involving Asian Americans jumped nearly 200%. Incidents involving sexual orientation rose nearly 50%. Michigan's Supreme Court today ordered indictments dismissed against former state officials in the Flint water scandal. Ex-Governor Rick Snyder had faced misdemeanor counts in the lead contamination crisis. The court found that a judge wrongly issued the indictments without using a grand jury. And on Wall Street, a sharp drop in consumer confidence pushed stock indexes down 1.5% to 3%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 491 points to close at 30,947. The NASDAQ fell 343 points. The S&P 500 slipped 78. Still to come on the NewsHour, clinics ramp up aid for women seeking abortions across state lines after the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. The U.S. ambassador to NATO discusses a critical summit at a time of uncertainty in Europe, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The governments of both the U.S. and Mexico are investigating the deadliest human smuggling case in modern U.S. history. At least 51 people died after they were trapped in a sweltering tractor trailer abandoned on the outskirts of San Antonio. Authorities are still working to identify the victims. Stephanie Tsai has more.
It was a worker in the area who heard the cries for help and found the tractor trailer, doors partially open, and inside, people piled on top of each other. Bodies were also found strewn along the road near the scene. More than a dozen other victims, including several children, were taken to the hospital.
The patients that we saw were hot to the touch. They were suffering from heat stroke, heat exhaustion, no signs of water in the vehicle. It was a refrigerated tractor trailer, but there was no visible working AC unit on that rig.
The heat index was more than 100 degrees in San Antonio on Monday afternoon. Authorities believe human traffickers were transporting the migrants. Among the victims were 22 citizens of Mexico, 7 from Guatemala and 2 from Honduras. The president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, commented on the tragedy.
These unfortunate events have to do with the situation of poverty and desperation of our Central American and Mexican brothers and sisters. It happens because there's also human trafficking and lack of controls at the border between Mexico and the United States and inside the United States.
Recent months have seen a record high number of attempted crossings from Mexico. In May alone, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agents encountered more than 230,000 migrants making multiple border crossing attempts. Even as a COVID public health order remains in place, essentially banning migrants. The Biden administration has attempted to lift the Title 42 restrictions, but a federal judge blocked its repeal. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg called for compassion.
So the plight of migrants seeking refuge is always a humanitarian crisis, but tonight we are dealing with a horrific human tragedy.
Customs enforcement has detained 3 people believed to be part of the smuggling conspiracy.
For more on the context in which these migrant deaths occur, let's turn to Aaron Reichlin Melnick, Policy Director of the American Immigration Council. Aaron, thank you for joining the NewsHour. You know, anyone who has been in the Southwest in the summer knows the heat can be deadly. And being inside an un-air-conditioned tractor trailer truck, it's just hard to imagine how high the temperatures got in there. Why would anyone take that risk, much less with children?
It's truly a horrific outcome. And unfortunately, the reality is that many migrants are taking this risk because they feel that there is no other way for them to get into the United States. Even the children, many of whom are trying to join family members in the United States, find that they really have no other options in order to come to this country. And so smugglers convince them to take routes that are inherently dangerous.
This has happened before. We see it again this year. Apparently, 290 migrants have already died trying to cross the southern border just in the first 6 months of this year, Aaron. And as we just reported, officials are reporting a record number of attempted crossings at the southern border since May. So the main Trump-era policies that were meant to deter migration during the pandemic, they're still in place, despite the Biden administration trying to get rid of them. The conditions are pretty much the same. How do those policies contribute to people continuing to try to cross this way?
Well, really what we've seen is that Title 42, the Trump-era pandemic health restriction, is still in place. And for individuals who are from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, nearly all of those migrants, especially those who are single adults, who are caught crossing the border are rapidly expelled back to Mexico. And that leads people to attempt to cross over and over and over again, trying to get through without being detected. Unfortunately, every time a person crosses the border like that, they're rolling a die and they're taking a chance that tragedy might occur. And unfortunately, what we saw yesterday is one of the worst tragedies of its kind.
And a federal judge, of course, has blocked the Biden administration's ability to repeal Title 42 for now. But you also have Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who is, of course, up for re-election in November and a Republican. He's blaming President Biden, saying the deaths are a result of open border policies and a refusal to enforce the law. Of course, you have Democrats on the other side saying it's because of Trump's closed border policies. Aaron, how do we make sense of all of this?
No person gets in a crowded truck and puts their life at risk if the border is open. The reality is that for the migrants who are in that truck, there was no way for them to come into the United States legally, even if they were attempting to seek asylum. Since March of 2020, the ports of entry have been shut to asylum seekers, And for migrants from Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries, there really is no way right now to access the asylum process or indeed to migrate legally. The reality is the vast majority of people who have come to our border and seek a better life have no legal ways to enter. And over the last 30 years, we have made the border harder and harder to cross in the safe locations, which has driven people into more and more dangerous routes. 2021 was the deadliest year on record at the border, and 2022 is going to be even worse.
And so you have people like Abbott's gubernatorial opponent, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke, saying that there should be more avenues open for legal migration. Aaron, given the scope of this tragedy, more than 50 people dead, do you see this coming up again for debate in Washington? More pathways for asylum, more pathways for legal immigration. Do you see the Biden administration prioritizing that more?
The Biden administration has said that it wants to expand pathways for legal migration and to address the root causes that are the reasons why people are leaving their homes in the first place. But we're in a congressional impasse right now, even though the American public, by a fairly large majority, supports increased access to migration. Unfortunately, all of this is caught up in the politics right now, and you have one party that has become very anti-immigration. And as we saw with former President Trump, even legal immigration was under attack. But when you cut off all avenues for legal migration, you are forcing people into more and more dangerous routes, and the chances of a tragedy occurring go up.
Aaron Reichlin Melnick with the American Immigration Council, thank you for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you for having me.
In the days since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, one state after another has outlawed abortion. Illinois is one of the few states in the middle of the country where people can still legally access abortion care. In this report, co-produced with the NewsHour, Kaiser Health News correspondent Sarah Varney traveled to Illinois to see what's happening there.
Along the highway from St. Louis, a billboard reads, "Welcome to Illinois, where you can get a safe, legal abortion." Hope Clinic stands out like a beacon.
Hope Clinic, this is Kate. How may I help you?
Amy Red Griner supervises the front desk.
So diagnostics are now not okay.
Today the clinic is closed, but on a normal day, what would this waiting room look like?
The waiting room would be full.
Patients travel here to Granite City from at least 19 states, including Texas, Florida, and Kentucky.
I'm standing here in Illinois, and just behind me is Missouri across the river. Normally, you wouldn't think twice about crossing state lines, but now these borders matter in terms of where women can access abortion care. So how busy have the phones been lately?
They have been ringing off the hook, especially on Mondays.
Dr. Erin King is an OBGYN and executive director of Hope Clinic.
People are coming to us much more, almost in states of crisis. There's much deeper levels of stress and anxiety, both around living somewhere that is telling you that what you're doing is wrong, and then having to come so far as the distance has increased and people's resources have decreased. It's really scary to see people will drive 200-300 miles, have multiple organizations help them, and still arrive and say, okay, don't tell anyone because I know this is illegal. Well, it's not illegal here.
Just 10 minutes away in Missouri, abortion is now illegal, with no exceptions for rape or incest. This clinic and others around Illinois have been preparing for this moment for months, years even. They're staying open later, adding weekends, beefing up staff, and they've even built new facilities.
We are seeing other colleagues start to come into the state where they may have been practicing in other states. They are moving their facilities or their practices into our state, which is going to increase access significantly. Do I think Illinois will be able to give all the access that is needed? No.
But one way women can access abortion as a growing number of states outlaw it is through medication abortion. It's been around since the early 1990s, but it wasn't approved by the FDA until 2000 for up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. Now, more than half of abortions are carried out using the two-pill regimen that stops the pregnancy and causes a miscarriage.
figure out how far along she is. If she's under 10 weeks, we'll go ahead and offer her the option for medical abortion.
It's been safely used for decades in countries around the world and is 99.6% effective.
There's data to show that it's safer than getting a penicillin shot, for example.
Dr. Sadia Haider is the Division Director of Family Planning at Rush University in Chicago. In many states, abortion pills can be prescribed via telehealth or obtained online.
When we think of self-managed abortion, pre-Roe, we think of coat hangers and botched abortions in alleyways. Is this the same moment?
We didn't have these medications back in those days. So we actually have very good medications now that safely can provide medical abortion, both in the hands of clinicians and in the hands of patients. There's a number of studies that have shown this, that patients can do this safely.
To do that, they sometimes need to leave home to have privacy from their children or an abusive partner.
We heard the story of one woman who wasn't able to have her medication abortion safely in her own home. So she relied on an abortion fund for financial support to finish the process at a hotel here in Decatur.
Over the last few years, as restrictions grew in surrounding states, Illinois has become a safe haven. In 2018, about 5,600 women came here from out of state for abortion care. In 2020, that number increased 70% to nearly 9,700.
We're driving to Chicago. That's where many women from the Midwest and the South have to travel in order to access abortion care. There are just far more clinics in the Chicago area than anywhere else in the state. And they're driving long distances. From Lexington, Kentucky, it's 400 miles. From Memphis, Tennessee, it's 530 miles. And from Houston, Texas, it's more than 1,000 miles. And that's just one way.
Fresh tea.
It's a busy morning at Megan Jaifo's house in Chicago. Her husband is getting their kids ready for camp.
Do you have your socks on?
And she and her colleague, Kadsia Sharif, have a long list of women who need their help. Together, they run the Chicago Abortion Fund, which helps women access care who can't afford it or live in states where it's illegal.
We heard in the Hope Clinic yesterday a lot of people coming from Tennessee, Kentucky, Texas, Oklahoma. What are some of the things people need in order to make that journey?
Definitely since the start of this year, being 2022, each month we see folks from at least 20 states. We're supporting a lot of folks who are calling us, trying to figure out, can I be seen in my home state? Is there a place close to me? Or maybe they're just like, I know Chicago, I'd rather just come to Chicago and get care.
It can be as simple as, you know, over the border in Indiana as a $14 train ticket. We have bought clothes for people who didn't think they were going to end up staying here for multiple day appointments, maxi pads, a hotel stay, a child care stipend. And something that we really try to underscore with our callers is that the difficulty you faced up to this point to get an abortion isn't a reflection of the morality of your decision to have an abortion. This is political. This has nothing to do with you, your body, your doctor, your choices. Those are yours. And we trust you to make a decision for yourself and your family that is powerful and brave.
Okay, and do you have health insurance right now?
The phone calls to the Chicago Abortion Fund are constant. Many of those women end up in Chicago at clinics like Family Planning Associates.
It's difficult to imagine how this ramp up will occur to be able to take care of all these extra patients. One day we're seeing our usual number of patients, and the next day, 20,000 more people who are calling.
Dr. Allison Cowett is the clinic's medical director.
At least half of people who seek abortion have used some form of birth control in the month prior to them seeking abortion. There will always be a need for abortion, whether it is because people got pregnant and weren't intending to get pregnant, because their birth control failed, also because there are many situations where women cannot stay pregnant for their own health and to save their own life. There are so many different reasons that women seek abortion.
How do you feel in this moment?
When I'm here at work, I have to say I feel very calm because I feel like we are part of a solution for so many people's lives. When I'm outside of my work environment, I do feel rage and I feel concern that we're not getting that word out there that this is a public health crisis and the end of women as equal partners in our society.
Thank you.
We've gone from one end of Illinois to the other. Just behind me in Wisconsin, clinics have stopped booking appointments for patients, forcing women to travel elsewhere. It's another example that borders matter. For the PBS NewsHour and Kaiser Health News, on the Illinois-Wisconsin border, I'm Sarah Varney.
Historic news this evening from the NATO meeting in Spain. Turkey has removed its opposition to Sweden and Finland joining the Security Alliance. The Scandinavian nation sought membership after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and a deal has now been struck. Our Nick Schifrin is in Madrid for the summit, which starts in earnest tomorrow, and he joins me now. So, Nick, hello. Tell us what led to Turkey changing its mind.
Weeks of back-channel diplomacy between Turkey, Sweden, and Finland, with the U.S. and NATO playing key roles. But, Judy, senior officials even here just a few hours ago didn't know whether this deal would go through. But it went through, and there was a signing ceremony just a few hours ago here in Madrid. NATO, Turkey, Finland, and Sweden, a trilateral agreement, really, in which Sweden and Finland gave in to some of President Erdogan's priorities. The agreement states, quote, Finland and Sweden unambiguously condemn all terrorist organizations perpetrating attacks against Turkey, and names the organizations that Turkey defines as terrorist. And that is what a senior Turkish official tells me tonight is the most important part of this document. Number two, the document says that Finland and Sweden will drop embargoes that prevented them from selling Turkey weapons, and Finland and Sweden will address Turkey's requests to deport and extradite Kurds living in those countries. Some of those extraditions actually include journalists, and the U.S., for one, has refused some of Turkey's extraditions demand in the past. But still, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made this agreement today, and he said it reiterated.
NATO's open door policy has been an historic success. Welcoming Finland and Sweden into the alliance will make them safer, NATO stronger, and the Euro-Atlantic area more secure. This is vital as we face the biggest security crisis in decades.
That, of course, is a reference to the war in Ukraine, which has really led, Judy, to a historic shift in European security in a matter of months. As you said, it has been many years that Sweden and Finland have been proud to be military non-aligned. Today, they believe they need NATO to prevent Russia from further attacking, even in their countries.
And Nick, you mentioned the U.S. Tell us about the U.S. role in bringing this about.
Yeah, it really played a key role, but it has downplayed that role from the very beginning. This morning, U.S., Sweden, and Finland really calibrated a key call that President Biden made to Recep Tayyip Erdogan right before Erdogan was leaving Turkey in order to come here to Madrid, as the senior U.S. official who told us put it, to get Erdogan in the right frame of mind. Right before Finland and Sweden made the deal today, they called President Biden just to get his final blessing. And the official said that Biden's really been coordinating all of this with Finland and Sweden since November, trying to get to this day. And the U.S. believes, Judy, that this is the most historic NATO summit in decades because of the combination of this expansion of NATO and the combined major increases in the deployment of NATO troops to Eastern Europe and an increased readiness of those NATO troops to deploy to Eastern Europe. And I talked about that topic with U.S. Ambassador to NATO Julie Smith before the Finland and Sweden announcement here in Madrid earlier today.
Ambassador Julie Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the major announcements coming out of this summit, of course, is bolstering defense on the eastern flank. And Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg yesterday announced that the number of troops on high alert would grow from 40,000 to 300,000. That's a big jump. What does it actually mean?
Right now, the alliance has something called the NATO Response Force. It's about 40,000 troops that are prepared to move within 15 days. By the end of this year, we're going to have a much larger pool of forces
pre-assigned and ready to go, and that will be up to 300,000, and with the possibility of deploying those troops on just a few days' notice.
How does it really make a big difference to have a number that is so much larger, but those troops are still in their home countries at base?
Well, you're right. NATO allies do have forces at their disposal. Those forces train together. NATO allies regularly exercise together. But what's new and different here is that we are, in fact, pre-assigning or picking out sets of forces that will be at the ready. So then when a crisis does bubble to the surface, NATO allies won't have to go around and have what we would call some sort of force generation exercise where you're asking countries what's available. In this case, we'll know exactly what allies have on hand, and those forces will be ready to deploy within days.
The other step is the number of troops actually deployed to Eastern Europe. Up until now, there's been about 1,000 troops, battalion level, in the three Baltic states as well as Poland, effectively as a tripwire. Not enough troops to defend those countries themselves. Those will go up to a brigade level, 3,000 to 5,000. Is that a high enough number, though, to actually defend that territory?
Well, what the alliance did a couple of months ago after Russia went into Ukraine is it actually tasked the commander at NATO, the SECUR, as we call him, General Walters,
to
conduct a review and try and determine what the alliance would need in its eastern flank to deter and defend against some sort of Russian attack or any attack in the future. He came back with the advice that those allies that currently have multinational battalions, that we should be able to scale those battalions to a brigade.
Then there's the question of the NATO strategic concept, basically a kind of national security strategy for NATO. The last time NATO had it was 2010, and it included this sentence: NATO-Russia cooperation is of strategic importance as it contributes to creating a common space of peace, stability, and security. At the time, you were at the Pentagon. You were the head of the director of NATO policy. Looking back, was the Obama administration, was all of NATO, frankly, naive?
Well, look, we rewrite this strategic concept, this kind of national security strategy, once a decade. And so when we sit down and do that, we do the best job that we can at the time. When we wrote the strategic concept in 2010, we were hopeful for a very different trajectory of NATO's relationship with Russia. Now, if you look back at what Russia did in 2014 in Crimea, if you look at what it's recently done in Ukraine again since late February, we're obviously in a completely different era and a different set of circumstances. So this strategic concept is going to say and look a lot different than the one from 2010. The language on Russia is going to reflect the current environment. It's going to reflect Russia's war in Ukraine, the war crimes that we've talked about there, the indiscriminate attacks against civilians.
The new strategic document identifies Russia as NATO's most immediate threat, but there's been differences, as you know, among NATO allies about how far to go. President Macron, for example, has said the West must resist the temptation to humiliate Russia. Do you agree with that?
I think we all come to the table with different perspectives. Every single member of the alliance has a different history with Russia, different proximity to Russia, different geography. We appreciate that the countries that actually border Ukraine or Belarus, where Russia has stationed tens of thousands of troops.
And just recently, President Putin warned that Belarus could have more Russian nuclear weapons.
Exactly. That we understand that those countries obviously look at the situation differently than the rest of us that have some distance from the war. But again, the fact that we have all come together and agreed on text that describes the threat and charts a path for NATO going forward is a remarkable moment in NATO's history.
Ambassador Julie Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Nick will be covering those NATO meetings in Madrid in days to come. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.